two young fathers are shot to death outside an iconic Utah restaurant.
I said, your dad has been hurt really bad.
The grief was disorienting for those left behind, until one choice changed everything.
I just remember writing this letter, and it wasn't me writing it.
Can a personal decision shape generations?
We're all falling for this guy's trick.
I'm Amy Donaldson. Season 2 of The Letter, Ripple Effect, is available now. Follow us at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Happy 2024! New year, new you, right? Let me guess. You're thinking about joining a new gym, starting a fad diet, buying that Theragun everyone's always yammering on about. I've got a better idea. Listen to my podcast. I'm Samantha Bee, writer, comedian, and host of Choice Words from Lemonada Media. This whole month of January, we're going to help you make better choices in 2024. We'll go beyond superficial hacks and get at the truth of how to lead a more meaningful life. Just search for Choice Words on your podcast player of choice and hit follow so you don't miss an episode. Now that is a good choice.
Lemonada.
Welcome to In the Bubble. I'm Dr. Bob Wachter. Before we get to today's topic, long COVID, let me say a few words about the CDC guidelines that came out last week. I think they surprised a lot of us. First of all, let's reflect on how these guidelines, which markedly relax masking and distancing requirements, how they came about. Well, they came about for one reason, and that is the miraculous effectiveness of our vaccines. As we think back over the last 18 months or so, COVID has delivered a lot of bad surprises, but the breathtaking effectiveness of the vaccines is something that we just have to be continuously thankful for. And I think about when the vaccines first came out, I just will never forget that moment in early November when we heard about the initial results from the Pfizer vaccine and its 95% effectiveness, and I literally jumped for joy. Since that time, virtually all of the additional news and data that we've heard about the vaccines has been positive. We didn't know how effective in real life, we saw these clinical trials, but we didn't know how effective in real life the vaccines would be in preventing cases, in preventing hospitalizations, in preventing deaths. We didn't know for sure how safe they would be, particularly after we followed people for a considerable period of time. We didn't know how effective they'd be against managing the variants. We didn't know, we said this over and over again, we didn't know how effective they would be in preventing asymptomatic carriage of the virus and potential transmission. We didn't know whether they'd work on kids. All of those questions have been answered, and the answers have been yes, 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 amazingly effective in preventing mild cases and preventing hospitalizations. Deaths. They are extraordinarily safe, even notwithstanding the J&J vaccine and the blood clots. We now know how amazingly rare they are. And for most people in the U.S. who've gotten vaccinated have gotten Pfizer and Moderna. And those vaccines now have been used for, we're closing in on a year since the clinical trial started. And there is absolutely no evidence of long-term side effects from these vaccines. So amazingly safe. Now the variants are here in a big way. The B117, the UK variant, is more than half the cases in the US, and the vaccines are extraordinarily effective even against these nastier variants. We now know that they markedly decrease the rate of asymptomatic carriage and transmission. We now know that they work on kids as young as 12, and almost no doubt that they will work on younger kids as well as the trials get completed. So we just have to be thankful that these vaccines work so well, and that really since January 20th, we've done an exceptional job distributing the vaccines, getting them out there, and we are now reaching numbers of people vaccinated. Yes, we're concerned about the slowing down of the pace, but the numbers that we have reached are real and meaningful and are providing a significant amount of down pressure on the number of cases, particularly in areas that have high prevalence of vaccination. Where I live in San Francisco, we're getting up to the 60-70% range of vaccination, and the cases have just melted away, and we're seeing that all over the country. So while we might not reach herd immunity as an entire nation, and as we're still seeing what's going on in India, South America, we're clearly not going to reach it in the world anytime soon, we are going to see regions in the country that reach a form of herd immunity where so many people are vaccinated that there is virtually no virus around, even as some new cases get introduced through travel. We've learned how safe being outside is, and so the CDC guidance about relaxing masking requirements outside was welcome. I hope they extend that more fully in the next week or so. I suspect they will, to include kids so the kids can play outside without masks over the summer. In terms of the new guidelines, which really relate to whether you need to do masking and distancing inside, I think it's welcome to say now that vaccinated people do not need to do that. And hopefully this will encourage more people to get vaccinated. The challenge, of course, is obvious, which is we don't have labels on our forehead that say vaccinated or not vaccinated. There's no good way to tell who is and who isn't vaccinated. And speaking personally, I still would not go into a crowded indoor space without a mask, even though I'm fully vaccinated, if there were going to be a lot of people there whose vaccine status I did not know. And you'll have to make that decision yourself as you reflect on the CDC guidelines and you reflect on what happens in your own town or region or state. But for me, my comfort level of going maskless in a crowded indoor space will either hinge on whether I am sure that everybody is vaccinated, and that, of course, will raise this issue of so-called vaccine passports, as I've predicted for months, what is sure to be the most controversial issue of 2021 in COVID. I'd encourage you to go back and listen to my conversation with Art Kaplan about that. So I would certainly feel comfortable doing that if everybody was vaccinated and I was sure of that. And I would feel comfortable if we got to a place where there was next to no COVID in that particular community. And where I live in San Francisco, we're getting close to that with a test positivity rate of less than 1% and about 20 to 25 new cases a day in a city of nearly 900,000. The chances that that person next to me in the bar or in the restaurant is infected is very, very low. So if you want to keep an eye on things, that's what I'd be looking at. If you want to ask yourself, am I comfortable being maskless and distanceless inside? First of all, keep an eye on whether you're confident everybody's vaccinated in the space. If you are, then that's absolutely a perfectly safe thing to do. If you're not, keep an eye on the case prevalence rate in your region and on the test positivity rate. Now, part of the reason I have caution about going inside in a place where people might not have been vaccinated is that although I'm quite confident being vaccinated, I'm not going to get super sick. I'm not going to die of COVID. I still don't want to get even a mild case of COVID, in part because we don't know for 100% certainty that even a mild case of COVID in a vaccinated person can't lead to the topic of today's conversation, which is long COVID. And so it's an interesting, troubling topic. It's one of those bad surprises that we've seen from COVID. I think in the beginning we thought about this fairly simplistically. You got COVID. Some people got pretty sick, but most people recovered. And if you recovered, you were fine. Tragically, many people did not recover and died. But we sort of thought about this in a dichotomous, you either die or you get better way. And we now know that there's this troubling middle ground where you don't die, but you have persistent symptoms for months, sometimes many months, sometimes we're now seeing over a year. I think you'll hear from our conversation that there are fantastic people working on this. Lots of patients and patient advocacy groups are involved, but it's also fair to say that we don't fully understand it. We're not in a position yet where we can accurately prognosticate. We're not in a position yet where we know what the best therapies are, although we're getting closer in certain areas. And part of the problem is we don't fully understand what's going on, whether this is from persistent viral infection, whether it's from persistent overreaction of our own immune systems, whether it's from inflammation of our blood vessels or something else, or a combination of all of that. And so it's a tough area. There's a lot going on. A lot of people are suffering from this, and it's important that we understand it better and continue to focus on caring for these patients the best we can, and studying long COVID so we can come up with better ways of prognosticating and better ways of preventing and treating it. The most important way of preventing it, of course, is vaccination. So, really interesting topic, really interesting episode, and I'm pleased to bring on our two guests to discuss it. One is Lakshmi Santosh. Lakshmi's a colleague of mine. She's a pulmonary and critical care physician at UCSF. She's also founder and the physician faculty lead of our multidisciplinary long COVID clinic, which is called the Optimal Clinic at UCSF Health. The other guest is Jennifer Frontera, who's a vascular neurology and neurocritical care specialist at NYU Langone Health. Since COVID-19 began, her research is focused on neurological complications of COVID, including long COVID. She's a member of the WHO Brain Health Neurology and COVID-19 Forum, which is studying COVID patients with neurological disorders from around the world. So let us bring on Lakshmi Santosh and Jennifer Frontera. All right, welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Before we get into the details of long COVID, I'd love to hear what motivated you to get interested in this topic. So, Jennifer, why don't you start?
Sure. So, I'm a neurologist and neurointensivist, and I'm based in New York. So, we were part of the first wave that spread through the United States. And you know, we really saw quite a volume of patients. And when we had the first wave, we started prospectively collecting data on the patients with neurological complications during hospitalization. And then we subsequently have been following them at 6 months, and we're doing our 1-year follow-up right now. So we have data both on patients with neuro complications during hospitalization, but also those who did not. So kind of a broad population of patients with moderate or severe COVID. So as part of that research, I've certainly been involved in people with long-term sequelae after severe or moderate COVID.
And did you have a sense from the beginning, from knowing about other viral illnesses, for example, that there would be sort of some patients with protracted symptoms?
You know, I have done work with Zika, with some colleagues in Rio during the Zika outbreak. And so we were looking at Guillain-Barré, for example. So I have a little bit of post-viral neurologic manifestation experience, but this was really quite different. And the spectrum of what we see following COVID is quite different. And the entire socioeconomic pandemic circumstances are different, which also play a major role in some of what we're seeing.
Great. And we'll get into those things some more. Okay, Lakshmi, what got you interested in this?
So I'm really interested in breaking down silos between inpatient and outpatient, critical care, and the ward. And so when our clinical division chief asked, is anyone interested in following these patients afterwards, I just jumped at that opportunity since I have this interest in looking at the spectrum and the continuity over different clinical contexts as I attend in the ICU, on the wards, and an outpatient pulmonary clinic. And I also saw quickly with reading the reports and the research done in New York, China, and Italy, that even though the people who are suffering from the long-term sequelae of COVID are just a small subset of those who were in the intensive care unit, so even though PASC and PICS, post-intensive care syndrome, have a very small overlap, kind of an integrated multidisciplinary approach is really helpful for both. So I was interested in kind of building a clinical framework that would work well for post-COVID, long COVID, as well as beyond for survivors of critical illness in general. And it's been an amazing learning experience, learning from colleagues throughout the country about this.
So just connect the dots for us, for those that aren't familiar with critical care. So it sounds like there is a syndrome that your field has been interested in people who have been in the intensive care unit, have been very sick, maybe been on ventilators, and they get off the ventilator and they leave and they are not well. There's still stuff going on. And that's something you were interested in even before COVID became a thing?
That's exactly right. We know that survivors of critical illness really have issues in four main domains: persistent pulmonary issues, lung function, physical functioning issues with difficulty, ambulation, getting around, mental health, which is critical, and then neurological manifestations. And so the post-intensive care syndrome really looks at all of those and asks about all of those systematically. And so we extrapolated that systematic whole body, mind and body framework to starting our long COVID clinic. And even though there's a small overlap between the populations, I really believe strongly that asking systematically about all of those domains is really important, as well as paying attention to the caregiver and family experience, which is another key principle in the post-intensive care syndrome or PICS literature. So I acknowledge that, again, that's a small tip of the iceberg of the people who are suffering from long COVID. However, the lessons learned from the decades of critical care research can certainly, some of the lessons learned can be applied to our long COVID population. And we also recognize that there are a lot of unique
factors of this pandemic, right? We see the persistent neurological symptoms and mental health symptoms in people who are not hospitalized, for example, which I'm sure we'll get into.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Debbie asked, what is considered long COVID? So is there a definition? Jennifer, do you want to start?
Yeah. So I sit on a few of the WHO panels for at least neurological sequelae or complications of COVID. And I think this is a work in progress in terms of the exact amount of time. Most people will quote greater than or equal to 4 weeks after the initial infection. And, you know, it's interesting, the NIH just put out, this request for applications for a series of post-acute sequelae of COVID or PASC grants. And even as part of that application, several people were asking, well, how do you want us to define post-acute sequelae? And they really just turned it back to the investigators saying, we don't know. but I think for all intents and purposes, most people would say it's, at least a month of prolonged symptoms or symptoms after a month following initial index diagnosis.
Okay. And DL Chu, maybe for you, Lakshmi, who is most susceptible to getting long COVID?
I'll answer that. And to also piggyback on what Dr. Frontera said, the cool thing about the term long COVID is that it is coined by patients. It's a patient-centered, patient-coined term. So I think in the research and clinical community, we started calling it post-COVID, post-acute sequelae of COVID, PASC, but the patient community worldwide has really rallied along this word of long COVID. And that language is important because it is disability inclusive. It acknowledges that that's a patient-centered or patient-initiated term. It acknowledges that for some people, it's more of a chronic course. So I'm trying to change my language and the way I talk about it to use long COVID more than the original title of our clinic was called the post-COVID clinic. And now we're, changing it to more the long COVID clinic, acknowledging those facts. So, Dr. Elisa Prigo is the one who coined the term. And since then, it's been well studied and a lot to learn. Who gets it? What are the risk factors? So there's a lot of emerging research in this area. And again, as Dr. Frontera said, the studies are difficult because some people will say this is a study for 30-day outcomes, 4-month outcomes, 6-month outcomes, 6-week outcomes. And so all of these studies are so heterogeneous, as well as the samples that we looked at. Is this a prospective, follow-up study longitudinally of all the VAs, like that Nature Medicine paper that came out? Is this a study of all of the NHS hospitals looking retrospectively? Or is this a study initiated by patient support groups like Survivor Corps and Body Politic? And so you have to think about kind of the inclusion and exclusion criteria and confounders and bias in any study that you interpret. So which is why the definition is so hard, the prevalence is so hard to estimate. So that being said, what are the risk factors that we know of? It seems that in contrast to who gets hospitalized and who dies, predominantly older male and people of color, particularly our Black and Latinx patients in America. And who has these longer lasting symptoms? In contrast, in many studies, it's been shown typically younger folks, more often female sex, more often white people. And some studies have maybe a link to higher socioeconomic status. And so again, we don't know if that's an underrepresentation of those populations or an overrepresentation of those populations. So I think this NIH study is going to really put money into things like defining the prevalence in a better way, looking at the risk factors, and looking at the biological basis.
Jennifer, anything to add to that?
Yeah. So we have a study sort of similar results for the patients with protracted COVID symptoms. We basically surveyed about 1,000 people in the U.S. population. that sort of mirror the demographics of the U.S. That's how the survey is constructed. And some people had COVID, some didn't. 8% responded as having had COVID. And that sort of matched the Hopkins data for the time that the study was conducted. Out of those patients, 25% of the patients that had COVID reported having symptoms that lasted more than a month. So that was a substantial subgroup. Amongst them, we did look at, we looked at socioeconomic stressors like social isolation, financial insecurity, food insecurity, domestic violence, et cetera. And they were strong, those factors were strongly correlated with the number of symptoms patients had, also with self-reported, what are called PROMIS or NeuroQol metrics. They're kind of ways of gauging levels of anxiety, depression. We looked at sleep, fatigue, and then subjective cognitive dysfunction also. And we did find, like other papers, that patients who were younger, more often female and Hispanic, and patients that had more histories of depression, anxiety, and higher levels of stressors were at higher risk of having persistent symptoms after having COVID.
So Lakshmi, when we talk, you mentioned that these are often not people that had critical illness, were not on a respirator or on death's door. They may have had a mild case. Do you ever see people that had no symptoms at all?
It's a really good question. So part of that is how you get your patient population and what is your kind of inclusion criteria, where your clinic recruits from. Our clinic sees a variety of people, those who are hospitalized as well as people who are not hospitalized. It is, some studies have reported that people can have long COVID symptoms after asymptomatic infection, but that is a smaller percentage. So I'm not saying it doesn't happen. It definitely happens. It is a smaller percentage. I think the biggest percentage, the biggest contributor is people who were sick with, quote, mild illness by WHO guidelines up front and then having persistent symptoms afterwards. Again, that's a really different population than the post-critical care population or even the post-hospitalized population. And then the asymptomatic population, some studies show, you know, ranging from, depends on the study, 2 to 20% of the people with persistent symptoms may have asymptomatic infection. And so those are vast numbers, prevalence estimates that I'm citing, which again shows the need for more research in this.
And when you point out the different groups of people, are if someone's initial presentation is, let's say, chest pain and shortness of breath, are they very likely to have those symptoms persist, or do people cross over? Their initial presentation was GI, for example, and then their long COVID symptoms are neuro or psychiatric. Maybe Jennifer.
Yeah, that's a great question, and I think, you know, at least what we're seeing in some of our preliminary data, it seems to be kind of a persistence of symptoms. Again, that is something that we're still unraveling. And as we do longitudinal follow-up on the same population, so you'd have to interview them multiple times serially, we'll get a better sense of how the symptoms change, but also how more quantitative measures of their outcomes change, which I think is really important to collect as well. So if we use standardized measures of anxiety, fatigue, depression, et cetera, sleep, I think that's meaningful because your level of anxiety and my level of anxiety, we may describe very differently, even though they may quantitatively be the same. So understanding that over time, I think is not to discount, you know, people's subjective symptomatology, but I think having objective measures of this will really give us some input and better understanding of what's going on and how people recover over time. We're doing a one-year follow-up right now on our first wave of patients. And, you know, we're repeating the same metrics we did at 6 months. So hopefully we'll see something in a positive direction, and that might be encouraging for some folks who have been infected more recently. But we'll see. We're still working through the data.
Well, to even take us through the 6 months, because so if you see a patient who is a month into it or 6 weeks into it and still feels pretty crummy from any of these symptoms, what do you tell them about what they're likely to feel like, let's say, 5 months from now?
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, we can develop models where we can look at predictors of how people are going to do, which we have done for 6 months. The people that wind up having more disabilities are the same people at risk for more severe COVID. So older people, males, people with high blood pressure, diabetes, other comorbidities like that, people with underlying depression or anxiety or other types of psychiatric illnesses. And then, of course, patients with dementia at baseline prior to having COVID tend to be more disabled at 6 months than people that don't have those issues. And lastly, you know, what our primary hypothesis was to look at people that had neurological events during hospitalization. And that certainly does impact many of those metrics, including your ability to engage in your normal activities, your ability to go back to work if you're working premorbidly, your ability to walk or do activities even around your own house. You know, and I will say that most of the neurological issues that we were looking at in the hospital were what we call encephalopathy or confusion. And so things that may not seem so severe to some people actually did really have sequelae that were important.
Yeah. I guess I'm still not clear, and maybe the answer is we're not clear. If I'm a 30-year-old woman who comes to see you a month out, and my brain just doesn't feel right. It's foggy. I'm not thinking as clearly as I was. I have no special risk factors for a bad outcome. Are you going to tell me that it's likelier than not several months from now that I'll feel fine, or we can't say that at this point?
Oh, so this is a very good question. And this is kind of what Lakshmi was referring to in a way. So at 6 months, I'm talking about follow-up from people that were hospitalized that had objective tests of their cognitive function. Like I had to administer an exam to you. And so that's quite different than a subjective cognitive test where you're asked to fill out a questionnaire basically about a bunch of your normal activities. Do you find it more difficult than normal to concentrate, to fill out a form, to et cetera, et cetera? So subjectively, on these types of quantitative measures and also based on reported symptoms, it's interesting that the people that are at risk for subjectively feeling bad or subjectively feeling like they have brain fog are different than the people that have objective quantitative abnormalities after being hospitalized for COVID. Mm-hmm. Completely different groups. So the people that do poorly after hospitalization are older men, multiple comorbidities. The people that subjectively have more symptoms of perhaps brain fog, headache, et cetera, and do worse on tests that measure how your subjective level of cognitive problems are younger women, Hispanics, really not that many comorbidities. So very different groups. And I think we have to work to figure out what the underlying reason for that is. And some of it is probably related to different stressors that these different groups are experiencing. But I think we have to really kind of parse them apart and study them separately in some ways. Because probably the interventions to help these people with what they're dealing with are going to be different.
Mm-hmm. I'll piggyback on that for two main points. One is that, as Dr. Frontera says, the symptoms that people experience not necessarily correlate with our validated measures of organ dysfunction. So what I mean by that is some people can feel really, really short of breath, but their breathing test, their pulmonary function test, can be normal, surprisingly. They could feel chest pain, but their echo and ultrasound of their heart could be normal. They could feel brain fog, but an MRI of their brain could be normal. And one of the things that's tricky and very humbling about this disease is that the opposite can be true. We can have people with really bad PFTs, lung function tests, and they're walking around saying, I actually feel okay. And so what I always say is, I believe the patients, believe their symptoms. This is not all in your head. I do a lot of talking to people and validating that this is, you know, experienced by millions of people worldwide. This is not in your head. I believe your symptoms, even if the organ dysfunction tests that we currently have are not showing up anything. And then the other thing that I tell people is, what is the long-term trajectory? What is the outlook? Am I going to feel like this forever? And what I tell people is that from the data that we have so far, most people in these studies are improving slowly over time. However, the symptoms that improve, that are more common to improve, are that chest pain and shortness of breath, those type of symptoms. The neurocognitive symptoms and the fatigue in many studies are often later to improve. So it's really tricky to predict. What I tell people is we don't know exactly for sure. We don't have a crystal ball. In most patients that I've seen that the research shows, they are improving, which gives us hope. These are what we can work on now to manage your symptoms now. And that most people are improving over time, but the fatigue particularly can be quite intractable in many patients. And so ongoing research and studies are needed.
Hi there, it's Julia Louis-Dreyfus. You may know me from my podcast called Wiser Than Me, where I talk to older women and get their wisdom from the front lines of life. After season one aired, I was amazed by how many people told me our show made them look forward to getting older, which is why I'm here to talk about season two of the show. Sally Field, Billie Jean King, Beverly Johnson, Ina Garten, Bonnie Raitt, just to name a few. And of course, my 90-year-old mom, Judy. All hail old women. Wiser Than Me Season 2 is out now from Lemonada Media.
Can't get enough of your favorite Lemonada Media podcasts? By subscribing to Lemonada Premium today, you'll gain access to fun and inspiring bonus content from all of our podcasts across the Lemonada Media Network. As a subscriber, you can listen to never-before-heard interview excerpts, behind-the-scenes segments, and continue to uncover new ways to make life suck less through all of our exclusive subscriber audio. Check out a free trial of Lemonada Premium today in the Apple Podcast app by clicking on our podcast logo and then the subscribe button.
Let's talk about treatment for a second. Why don't we start with the question of whether vaccines are useful? Is there any evidence about that? I know this was sort of anecdotal in the study when we first heard about it. And then are there any treatments that have been proven to be useful? It sounds like it would be kind of a mix of things because the symptoms are so varied.
So there's been kind of one small study that's come out, and it really was a very small study, less than 100 people, looking at essentially the safety of vaccines in patients with long COVID. And it found that some people did better, a minority felt worse, and then some people stayed the same. And the main researcher who's now investigating this is Dr. Akiko Iwasaki at Yale, who is doing research on exactly those hypotheses that we talked about. Is it autoimmunity or autoantibodies? Is it a persistent virus reservoir in your body, or is it inflammation related to it? So as of now, what I tell people is that if you had COVID, please still get the vaccine. Our UCSF infection control guidelines say to wait 90 days or 3 months after your first infection. And that's both to kind of avoid excessive side effects, as well as that early immunity in the first 3 months is quite strong from your natural infection. But I say, if you've had COVID before, please still get the vaccine, because that's going to be a more durable, long-lasting immunity than the natural immunity. And some preliminary data show that it may help you. It certainly, in the small study that exists, doesn't hurt. And Dr. Iwasaki at Yale is currently studying this.
I will also add that there was a New England Journal small article really suggesting that people who have had COVID and then get vaccinated generate an even better immune response than people who have just been vaccinated. So it's a win-win across the board. You might even get better. So certainly we would support vaccination for people with COVID, long COVID, or without COVID at all.
Okay. So Jennifer, take us through other potential treatment modalities. If I had long COVID, I'd come in and I would wonder about getting an antiviral drug. I would wonder about getting something that's going to modulate my immune system, if that may be part of what's going on. So how do you talk through those issues with patients?
Yeah, so I think it's immune modulators certainly have a risk to them, and really at this point, no clear benefit in the post-acute setting. Very different than in the acute setting. So I think at the moment we're dealing with a lot of kind of supportive therapies, which might be physical therapy. Keeping in mind the lessons that we've learned from chronic fatigue syndrome, that you have to be very measured in terms of activity, that excessive activity will really exacerbate people that have chronic fatigue syndrome, for example. And so we want to try to keep that in mind when we're gauging people's responses to physical therapy. There's also cognitive therapy, for example, as well as some, I think, data coming out on neuropsychiatric types of management of depression and so forth, And for fatigue, people are looking at what we often use, which would be melatonin at night, and then potentially a neurostimulant in the morning, which could be methylphenidate, it could be amantadine. There's a variety of different things that have been studied for arousal. I think those are the options at this moment. None of them have very robust data, but I think at least it's one way to approach dealing with people's debilitating symptoms.
Lakshmi, anything that else that you are using or you're particularly excited about seeing clinical trials in for these patients?
I really want to emphasize the do not prescribe list. I worry that in this area of great therapeutic uncertainty, there's a lot of snake oil salesmen and women who have come out of the woodwork marketing ineffective, unproven, and sometimes frankly dangerous therapies to our patients and preying on their fears. I've had patients be approached about IV therapies, IV vitamins, IV ozone, things like that, IV remdesivir, Tamiflu, antiviral. So none of these work. Steroids for long COVID symptoms is something that I would definitely not recommend. I've seen a lot of patients who've been on prolonged courses of corticosteroids, prednisone, and have a lot of complications from that. There have been studies of anti-inflammatory medications like interferon, antivirals, all of that has not panned out. And so what I tell people is, I'm interested in treating your symptoms now and helping you feel better now. And because there is no one long COVID, there is no one long COVID treatment plan. So if you're predominantly in that, you know, dysautonomia, postural tachycardia, POTS type person,
let's translate those things back into English.
Yep. So dysautonomia, POTS, what does that mean? Some people with long COVID symptoms, when they stand up suddenly, they basically feel really, really heart racing, short of breath. And that's because some people with long COVID have this response where the nervous system is basically kind of turned on inappropriately or inappropriately fast, and that your heart races way faster. So that can be connected too with chronic fatigue symptoms in some cases. In fact, it's one of the criteria for chronic fatigue syndrome is to have that. So some people are having a lot of issues with that, with difficulty with fast heart rate, shortness of breath when standing up or when walking. We do a lot of things to coach them to break that cycle, talking about fluid intake, salt intake, compression stockings, and in rare cases, some medications for that. For the fatigue, as Dr. Frontera mentioned, there are trials ongoing of neurostimulants, improving sleep. There are some trials ongoing of low-dose naltrexone for chronic fatigue type symptoms. I think all the behavioral interventions are really important. I always talk to my patients about treating everything that you're experiencing, and treating mental health is a huge pillar of that. So I emphasize that there is a strong mind-body connection, especially with my specialty, pulmonary shortness of breath. You can get into a vicious cycle with shortness of breath and anxiety, and they can drive each other. And so treating that, we talk about breathing exercises. There's a great website for kind of free breathing exercises, almost like a mini pulmonary rehab, which is a guided exercise program for people's lungs that I recommend for people. Pulmonary rehab is something that is covered by many insurance companies for people who are having issues with long COVID. And so I ask people to ask their doctors about that or look at if I could prescribe it for that. And then physical therapy, cognitive therapy, if appropriate, and a lot of linkage to supportive resources. So the other thing that I would emphasize, Bob, is that not all that long hauls is COVID. And what I mean by that is I have folks coming to me 9 months after diagnosis, a year after diagnosis, 6 months after diagnosis, and saying, I have this new rash. I have these new headaches. Mm-hmm. This I didn't have before. And either they themselves or their doctors or their clinicians have labeled them as, oh, it's just your long COVID. And in our clinic, we have diagnosed, sadly, metastatic cancer, hypothyroidism, hypersensitivity pneumonitis, which is basically an allergic reaction in the lung to something in the environment, postpartum depression, et cetera. And so I always say, put those thinking caps on, think broad, don't anchor on one differential diagnosis, don't anchor on the diagnosis of long COVID, but think broadly. And so I tell people, if they have new symptoms popping up, don't just attribute it to long COVID, especially in this era of deferred care where people have put off their doctor's visits, put off those colonoscopies and mammograms. Yeah. I just ask people to take these new symptoms really seriously.
That's a really good point. Kim Senna asked, my 19-year-old had COVID at the beginning of January, flu-like symptoms for 48 hours, and then lost his taste and smell, and they've not yet returned. Is there anything I can do to speed up the recovery there? And also, what is the prognosis of that particular symptom, which is can be debilitating? Jennifer, what have you seen with that?
So there is an olfactory rehab type of thing you can, or therapy type of things that you can do. And the good news is that most people that have loss of sense of taste and smell, it usually does recover over a few weeks. And I think neuropathologically, though the literature is very mixed, I think most of it shows that SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID, is affecting basically the lining of your nose, of where the sensory neurons are for smell, rather than the neurons themselves. And in that case, they should recover. Sometimes it takes longer for some folks than others. But I think the cases where people are reporting like months to a year of loss of sense of taste and smell are rare. So most people will recover over a period of weeks or possibly less.
And how that actually works, there was a great New York Times article on it, actually. And what I tell people anecdotally in our clinic is, you know, you can train your brain where for a week, try to smell something really strong that's citrus. And so you're kind of saying citrus and you're focusing on citrus this week. And then the next week, picking a different scent, you know, mint, something really strong. And so there's some great, both popular press as well as ENT, ear, nose, and throat literature on that olfactory rehab or smell retraining.
Nasal rehab, who would have thought? Brian Spaulding asked, have any of the variants been shown to produce greater incidence of long COVID?
That's a good question. I will say that I think we have not done as much genotyping in this country as we would like to. Okay, so it's still like a special kind of laboratory test. It's not a routine thing. And so because of that, and because long COVID is still remaining as a not as well-defined entity as we would like, I think that there's, at this point, not great evidence that any given variant is more likely to produce long COVID. Some variants are associated with more severe forms of acute COVID. That is known. But the prolonged symptoms or the post-acute COVID is less clearly tied to any one genotype. I don't know if Lakshmi wants to add anything to that.
I would agree. I would just say we don't know yet. And either way, the variants are something that, you know, as Bob likes to say, it's kind of a race right now, the vaccines versus the variants. And so only time will tell and further research to be done.
I just, if I could just piggyback on something that Lakshmi had mentioned earlier regarding the idea of really addressing mental health issues. Unfortunately, in our society, it's a taboo really to talk about mental health. And yet, you know, at least in one of our surveys, it looked like 30 to 40% of Americans, even without COVID, are dealing with depression and anxiety right now. It's a very stressful time. And I think that acknowledging and dealing with that is absolutely elemental for whole body health, as well as any symptom you might be dealing with from long COVID. So I think that, you know, putting that out there in the open and saying it's okay to really deal with mental health symptoms is absolutely essential for getting to the bottom of some of what people are dealing with long COVID.
Yeah, it strikes me that you must have a delicate balancing act to go through with many of these patients. As Lakshmi said, it was very important to tell them it's not in your head. And yet, very clearly, there are elements of it that either link to pre-existing anxiety or depression or bring out anxiety or depression. How do you articulate that in a way that doesn't feel like you're telling me one thing and then you're treating me a completely diametrically opposed way?
Well, I mean, I like to say, first of all, anxiety and depression are neurochemical imbalances, okay? Sometimes when people use the term in your head, it implies, I don't believe you, there's nothing wrong with you. Mm-hmm. That is not at all what we're saying. These people's symptoms are real and they're debilitating and need to be dealt with and addressed. And that is for sure. But, you know, I tell people like depression and anxiety have really strong foundations in neurotransmitter abnormalities. Neurotransmitters are the way that your neurons talk to one another. That is a physical problem that we can fix, thankfully, with a variety of different medical options. I view it as another type of physical problem that people have that we can address. And I really do hope that the stigma surrounding mental health care, that some of those barriers can really start to fall down. I just think it's largely untreated.
I totally agree. And to address that, that's why when you come to our clinic and many of these clinics around the country, your first visit is with a pulmonologist and either a psychiatrist or a mental health specialist, a psychiatrist, psychologist, or a psych social worker. And so we, when we're making our appointment, give the patient upfront those two appointments and normalize that. Before our appointment, we give them mental health screening questionnaires and respiratory symptom screening questionnaires, normalizing that mental health is health. This is absolutely part of our integrated, multidisciplinary, holistic approach. And it is so important to treat everything we can with multiple modalities. So you're totally right, Bob, that I always acknowledge to people that there's so much that we don't know. Mm-hmm. We're still studying. And in the meantime, let's treat everything that's going on effectively every way we can. And we know that, you know, anxiety makes dyspnea, makes shortness of breath worse. So let's treat both of those. Let's treat the anxiety with, you know, therapy and anti-anxiety meds. And let's treat with shortness of breath with pulmonary rehab, breathing exercises, measuring your lung function tests, and excluding anything else that might be going on. So I think when people come, they have the sense of, oh, she and they are really looking at trying to understand what's going on with me and not just putting me in a mental health box. Because I think that's what people don't like to be labeled as, that, okay, this is just anxiety. Mm-hmm. And I think telling people that this is a whole body approach, we're going to treat everything we can with multiple modalities, is helpful. And also keeping that differential diagnosis antenna broad to say, I'm also really interested in to figure out, is there something that I've missed? Is there something that we've missed? Are we anchoring on this diagnosis of long COVID? So I think that helps people feel heard and understood, and that approach is helpful.
Hi, I'm June Diane Raphael.
And I'm Jessica St. Clair.
And each week we are sitting down to talk all about life's twists, turns, and absurdities on The Deep Dive.
From exploring the depths of TikTok, which is our only news source, to navigating the complexities of grief and loss, we are just two best friends behind a mic processing life together.
This podcast is all about finding the silver linings in the madness. So get ready for unfiltered conversations about motherhood, careers, pop culture, and everything in between.
Here at The Deep Dive, we're all about community. We believe in the power of sharing experiences and the strength that comes from supporting one another. And we would love to have you with us.
So be sure to join us every Wednesday on The Deep Dive from Lemonada Media, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to The Dough, where cash is queen and we hardly know her, but we're still here figuring her out together because, y'all, season two is here. Hosted every week by me, X Maya. Remember me? I'm going to be talking to all types of people about their relationship to money. I'm talking to reality stars, entrepreneurs, financial experts, and even some of my own friends. Basically, anyone who will get real with me about their dollars, how they make money, how they spend it, and how they save it, because I'm trying to retire early, people. Season two of The Dough is out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
So let me end by looping back to where we started. I asked you what got you interested in this, and you're both intensivists by training. You take care of really sick people in the intensive care unit. You have a ton of data at your disposal. Although there's a fair number of situations with uncertainty, you know, we understand the illnesses quite well. We often have a pretty good database on which to prognosticate. And you've both chosen to get involved in a set of diseases or, you know, and clusters of symptoms that we understand very little about. I'm sure many patients are frustrated and scared and don't know if this is going to go on for 3 months or 3 years or forever. We don't really know how to treat a lot of it. So what keeps you going and what do you find gratifying about this work today?
I think this work is incredibly personally gratifying to me. Just as whether I'm in the ICU, in the hospital, or in clinic, I get great satisfaction out of being people and helping them through the worst days of their life, the worst months of their life. That's why I went into medicine and into palm critical care and hospital medicine. And in our clinic, seeing people with that continuity of someone who I took care of, who was on death's door, seeing them walking into clinic and talking to them, it's very often that there's tears on both sides. And so it's very rewarding. I think that the uncertainty pushes me to keep up with the literature, to learn from colleagues, to help colleagues across the country set up their own clinics to help people. So it has been a very personally rewarding journey to see how I can help in any way I can. And the sessions are honestly inspirational.
Well, I think, you know, we're dealing with a once in a lifetime situation right now, where things are moving incredibly quickly and millions of people are affected. If we were to extrapolate the number of Americans, for example, living with long COVID from at least our preliminary small data from, you know, 1,000 people, that would translate to about 6.25 million people right now living with protracted symptoms of COVID. This is a huge problem. Certainly for the people that are dealing with this personally, it's a huge problem. But then also for us as a society, it's a huge problem if we have folks that are not able to go back to work, engage in their normal activities. So there's a lot of repercussions to this. I don't think there's ever been a more pressing issue, at least in my lifetime, that we've confronted medically with as much urgency as dealing with the fallout from this virus. So, I mean, I feel compelled because of the sheer magnitude of the effect, the fact that we know so little and so many people are affected so severely that I just think there's a lot of work to do. And that really drives me to move faster and harder, I think, to get answers to help a lot of people who are suffering.
Yeah, I promised that was the last question, but I guess I just thought of one more. I feel like I will not be doing my public service duty if we don't take an opportunity to do a vaccine PSA. So some people say, I don't want to get vaccinated. I'm young, I'm healthy, and if I get COVID, I'm going to get a mild case. And I'm guessing you've seen patients with long COVID that would make you give those folks a little bit of a speech about why vaccination might be a good idea. Either one of you want to take that opportunity to do that?
Yeah, we both do, I'm sure.
do. Exactly. Any talk that I give about long COVID, that's exactly what I say. I say, this is not black and white. This is not life and death. That's the statistics you read in the newspaper. This many people died, this many people recovered. But recovery for some people means months of being unable to return to the work, to do laundry, to do dishes. Our patient stories are heartbreaking. I see a lot of healthcare workers in my clinic, physicians, nurses, other healthcare workers, and it is heartbreaking hearing these stories. And so any opportunity to prevent this cycle, this cluster of symptoms that could be affecting people months out with a preventable illness that's just a shot in the arm, please, please take it. Don't hesitate. And I think from a societal level, the more of us that get the vaccine, the closer we can return to normal. I want to go to a concert like I see my colleagues who are intensivists in Australia and New Zealand doing. I want to go to a concert without a mask. I want to do a lot of indoor dining. I'm a foodie without a mask. And the closer that all of us get to, you know, better vaccines for all, the more people get vaccinated, the closer we'll all get to normal. And you know, I tell people, I don't want to see you in my clinic. Please, this is preventable.
Yeah. Jennifer, anything to add there?
Yeah, I would say that, you know, the concerns about side effects from a vaccination are, you know, really less than one in a million in terms of seriousness. And I will just remind people that when we had the first surge in New York, our mortality rates for people hospitalized was 25 to 30%. That's unbelievable. And so would you rather take a one in a million chance that you have a potentially treatable side effect, or would you risk actual death by getting COVID? And nowadays that a lot of our older folks are vaccinated, we're seeing younger people coming into the hospital with acute and severe COVID. So no one really is immune from this virus in the metaphorical sense. You can be immune in the technical sense if you get vaccinated, but everyone is really at risk. And so I think that really has to be taken seriously. And I agree with Lakshmi. We'd all like to go back to life as normal. We'd all like to not have our ICUs filled with people that are so, so sick. And, you know, certainly these folks that are suffering for months with protracted symptoms that keep them from even doing their favorite activities, that should be enough to sort of motivate folks to go out and get vaccinated and avoid all of this. It's so easily avoidable.
Yeah, boy, you would hope so. I think at this point, we know that every person that we see like this, it probably was preventable. So it will add to the tragedy. And I think the point you both made that it's not just simply a black and white, you die or you get better. You're seeing a lot of people who are not better. And we hope we'll find better treatments for them. But for now, knowing that for a lot of them that this could have been prevented is really, really adds to the tragedy. Thank you both for the work you're doing in this area. It's really important and I know really hard, but it sounds like quite gratifying and it is quite meaningful. So, and thanks for coming on today to describe it for us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Bob.
Well, a special thanks to Lakshmi and Jennifer for taking care of these really complicated patients and helping us expand the frontier of what we understand about them and for that discussion. Let me emphasize again the last point I made with them. At least in the United States now, everybody over age 12 has access to vaccination, meaning every new case that we see of COVID and eventually every case of long COVID that we see from an infection that happens now, we really can say to ourselves that was preventable, could have been prevented had someone gotten vaccinated. So if you're not vaccinated, now is the time to do it. If you have friends and family who are not vaccinated, please continue to talk with them, encourage them to do it. Even if they say, I'm at low risk of getting super sick and dying, that does not mean, as you heard, that they're at low risk or minimal risk of getting long COVID. And as I hope the conversation impressed upon you, you don't want to get that, even if you ultimately survive your bout of COVID. So I'll be doing one more episode with you, this one on COVID and the restaurant industry, which has gotten battered in the past year and is now coming back to life. I'll be talking to celebrity chef and restaurateur Justin Sutherland. After that, we'll take a brief break to prepare for Andy Slavitt's return to the show, which I look forward to. In the meantime, we'll replay a few of our best episodes over the last several months, and so you won't need to go completely bubble-less during a few week hiatus before Andy's return. So until I return with you with Justin Sutherland, please stay safe, please get vaccinated, and I look forward to talking to you soon. We're a production of Lemonada Media. Chrissy Pease and Alex McGowan produced our show. Our mix is by Ivan Kuryev. Jessica Cordova Kramer and Stephanie Whittleswax executive produced the show. Our theme was composed by Dan Molad and Oliver Hill, and additional music by Ivan Kuryev. You can find out more about our show on social media at In the Bubble Pod. Until next time, stay safe and stay sane. Thanks so much for listening.
Do you ever get hit with a cringy memory of your 13-year-old self out of nowhere and suddenly you're panic sweating and laughing at the same time? Don't worry. We all get that. It's because being an adolescent is one of the most visceral shared experiences we have as people. And we want to talk about it. Join me, Penn Badgley, and my two friends, Nava and Sophie, on Podcrushed as we interview celebrity guests about the joys and horrors of being a teenager and how those moments made them who they are today. New episodes of Podcrushed are out on April 24th, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, friends, it's Meghan Trainor.
And her big bro, Ryan Trainor.
And her husband, Daryl Sabara.
Each week on our podcast, Working On It, we share behind-the-scenes stories and bring you into our hilarious and heartfelt conversations, and sometimes with amazing guests.
We tackle everything from navigating Hollywood to mental health to Meghan becoming a mother, Daryl becoming a father, and so much more.
We'll get into the nitty-gritty of our lives and leave no detail behind. Prepare to laugh, cry, and hopefully learn something new.
Listen to new episodes out every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts.